No, I have my trouble with it. Before you open it up.
How long has your family been in this area? I noticed Doty Road, and behind the house here, there's Doty Cemetery. It seems like it's been quite a while.
Yes, they came here when Michigan became a state in 1837, and we've been here for 150 years in this corner. They originally came from upstate New York, and as the mass migration from Michigan took place, a lot of people from New York came to Southeastern Michigan.
Was this originally one of what they called a French ribbon farm, something
yes,
like that?
Yes, it is a French claim. The story of the family is that this farm was one of the original claims. There are several claims now, but one of the original claims was 17 rods wide and 5 miles long. And my father always pointed out a field north and east of Navy, which was the end of the claim, which would be about 5 miles back there. Of course, the old story of the Frenchman is that the claims were irregular in length, and the old story of the Frenchman is they took a jug of whiskey and took off for the back from the rivers, and when the whiskey went dry, they drove their stake, and that was the claim. You know.
That's an interesting story. It was originally to the north and east of what is now the village of Navy.
Yes, yes. But we were not the original claimers. The French, by the name of Godfrey, got the original claim from the United States government in, I think, the 1820s.
Wow. And then your family settled here 1830s?
37. We bought the farm from Godfrey. In my youth, I can remember an old corn crib building to the back of where we now are located. And that, my mother used to tell us, was the old house. And apparently, as I see back through the years, that that's where the Frenchman built his house. And it was high on the bank of the River Raisin, probably 150 yards back from here, in front of the cemetery. And then they built this house during the prosperous years of the Civil War. The war came along and made some prosperity, and they built this house in which we now live, completed in 1865, at a cost of $800. They borrowed $300 and a lot of the timber, and an old man who was old in my youth, I asked him where they got the bricks, and he said they made them. So I assume that they did make the bricks here.
I'm sure they did. 1865.
Yes, that's when this section was completed. We have reason to believe that the other sections, the lower sections, were built earlier, you know, probably in the early 60s.
Mm-hmm.
One of the stories of the family is that Eddie, who was Joseph Doty's, one of the original man here's children, was 16 or 17 years old, and they criticized the mortar he was mixing, and he took off, and they never saw him again. He was joined the army during the Civil War and was killed down in Georgia. I don't know whether I believe it's with Sherman or somebody down in there. He was killed in the Civil War.
Mm-hmm. Now, is this here, this is the original homestead. I know there's other Dotys that live along the road here, but
yes,
this is the original homestead.
This is the original homestead. It went from here to Doty Road down here. And when my great-grandfather divided up his estate, he gave a portion from Doty Road to here on this side of the road, on the north side of the road, to William Doty, a son who built a house back on Doty Road, and that is still a Doty farm back there. And they are also a bicentennial 150-year farm, but it's the farm, the land right next to us, that is the centennial farm, not where they live. And then he gave my father this side of the road, my grandfather this side of the road, and a long narrow strip back to the north. That's the main farm there.
How many acres are involved with the farm at this time?
Oh, my boy and I have over 400. It was originally, when my dad got it, it was 128. But my boy and I have 400 acres.
How long have you had the dairy cows?
Well, I suppose there have been dairy cows here for 150 years. That's what I think, anyway. My dad went into, because in the new home here in 1860s, they built a cream cooler in the cellar with vats where a water system would come through and cool the milk, and the water would be drained down out. The vat is still down in the basement. And I remember as a youth, we used to have a cream separator down there, and the excess milk that couldn't go to the dairy for some reason, we had to separate it. We used to take down there in the basement and use a DeValve cream separator by hand, separate the milk and save the cream.
So you've been exposed to the dairy animals and the farming most all of your life?
Oh, yes, all my life. My dad went to Short Course in the early 1900s, about 1908 or 9, and then he came back, and that was about the beginning of the dairy business, and all over, where every farm had a few cows, and he built silos and built the barn and built the milk house, and he hauled milk to a milk station in Mabee, where they transported it to Detroit Creamery Company in Detroit. So yes, we've been in the dairy business, but we're just about out. I hope by next fall we'll be out of the dairy business. Mm-hmm. For health reasons and other reasons. Mm-hmm. I may go on to January 1st, 1990, so I can say we milked into the 90s.
Yeah. I understand you were involved with community government quite a bit throughout your life. What brought you to become involved with that? And you had all the responsibilities of the farm and family. What motivated you to get involved with the government?
Well, it was a rather natural thing. My father was a township supervisor and active in so many things in the community all his life that it just seemed like a ritual that went on. And when my father died in 1944, I was 20 years old. They thought of naming me supervisor then, but they didn't. And a few years later, I was elected clerk of the township. And 4 years after that, I was elected supervisor. And I don't know how many years I was supervisor, about 20, I guess. And I was chairman of the county board of supervisors 3 times during that period. Supposedly, I was one of the youngest men ever elected chairman. But you ask about my involvement. It was just a natural thing. I was active in 4-H club work. And had done quite well. I won many state honors, and it just I had a lot of backing from the community, a lot of knowledge of the people, and it worked very well.
Mm-hmm. Was there any particular thing that you wanted to accomplish when you entered the...
No, I just wanted to govern. I believe that it's a responsibility one should accept to be a part of the community and represent one's philosophy. I don't particularly care to represent a group of people. I represent a philosophy, and if people agree with me, they vote for me. And when the nature of the county changed from liberal to from conservative to liberal, or from Democrat to Republican, then my political career was over. So it was no longer willing to adjust or whatever to the new kind of philosophy. I wish to maintain my own philosophy.
What do you feel through your experience, was responsible for that change?
Well, the urbanization of the county has been a big factor in the political change that's taken place, being located between Detroit and Toledo and the Ann Arbor area. We've had a lot of, particularly in the last 20 years, tremendous urban growth, and those people, by and large, were union-oriented people who were quite liberal in their philosophies. We are yet fortunate here in Raisinville Township. We have maintained a more or less old-fashioned type of government. They're really responsive to the will of the people, and they don't go around playing a lot of political games like a lot of the bigger townships. They have very unstable supervisors that keep moving on and on. In fact, since 1930, we have probably had only four supervisors: Fred Gruber Sr., my father, Guy J. Doty, Fred Gruber again, and then myself, Donald D. Doty, and the now supervisor, Chuck Burke, who's been supervisor for the last 20 years. So we have a very, very stable government here, but it doesn't reflect what's happened in the county. The county's political system has changed completely with the moving in of new people.
Was there ever one particular situation or idea or anything that came up throughout your time with the township that you were particularly interested in, that you were real opposed to or absolutely for? Any one thing that stands out in your mind?
Not especially. We were quite progressive, and we felt that even though with our conservative philosophy we were quite progressive, we had the first building code among the rural townships in the county. I secured the services of a building inspector in Monroe who drafted us a minimal code. I didn't want to draft a code that would be tough on the farmers who wanted to build a building for farm purposes, and so we adopted a minimal code, which was later adopted by many townships throughout the county. We were the first to have voting machines. We were at the forefront of using sales tax diversion money, which was an amendment that came in the 50s, to improve our township roads. And it's a program that's been continued on by this present group of people who run the government, to the point where there are very, very few dirt or mud roads left in the township. And so Mr. Gruber and I were the instigators of spending our money for roads, and it's been a joy to see that we've accomplished so much in the last 40 years in that regard.
How has this, you've probably noticed, just in the years that I've been around, I've noticed this mechanization of farming. How do you feel this has affected this particular township, Raisinville Township? I mean, it used to be a four-bottom plow, a six-bottom plow was big. Now we have four-wheel drive tractors with their implements all folded up in the air and everything else.
Well, it's affected Raisinville Township the same way it's affected every place else in the Midwest. And the fact that the smaller farms are going out, it isn't necessarily being added to other properties as far as ownership goes. what I'm trying to say is the ownership is probably an absentee ownership where a few farmers like Mr. Meyer and Mr. Keenline and those people who work 3,000 to 5,000 acres are moving in, and whenever a farmer sells out, they rent this land, and it's largely on a rental basis. It's been a very negative thing as far as I'm concerned. It's awfully hard for me to drive through the countryside and see the deterioration of the farm situation. Mm-hmm. When I was a young man, you'd go to the field and see farmers working to the left and to the right, and you'd talk to somebody over the fence. Now you can go out on your farm and not see another tractor all day long, even in the spring of the year. They come in with these big four-wheelers, as you say, and swoop down and do a field and are gone within a few minutes. And it's a whole different environment out there.
Mm-hmm. Now you probably remember east of here, the St. Mary's farms.
Oh, yes.
Do you remember when they were actually taking care of the academy, when the academy and the mother house all...
Oh, my, yes. Some of my first memories are of going down to St. Mary's farms with my dad. Yes. In fact, the West St. Mary's farm was my grandfather Newcomer's farm, and I realize now that's why my father was so close to St. Mary's. In their heyday in the 30s and 40s, when a man named Julius Van Slambrook from Belton was here running it, they really had a magnificent farm. And Julius Van Slambrook went back to Belton, had his own farms, and frequently visited here. But yes, I remember St. Mary's. The road was built in 1928, and it's largely through St. Mary's influence in Lansing that North Custer Road was completed. As I say, their influence in Lansing. I can remember when North Custer Road was a mud road. I can remember when, as a very young child, my father hooked up the mules to the buggy in the spring of the year when we couldn't run the car because of the mud road, and went to a funeral in Dundee. It's my only memory of riding in a horse and buggy for actual transportation.
How did St. Mary's come about, all that land?
A man by the name of Grover Humphrey had a big farm down here, about 400 acres. And he was a lawyer in town and lived in what was the main farmhouse, my father tells me. And they decided they wanted to get into the agriculture business of St. Mary's Academy to service the women's college here, which, in my memory, it was at the corner of Monroe Street and Elm, where the Custer statue now stands. I remember that woman. And to service Mary Grove College in Detroit, which was a branch of the Sisters of the Service of St. Mary's. And then about 1920, this was before 1920, because about 1920 they bought my grandfather Newcomer's farm, and then they bought a Kemmerling farm and on down until they accumulated almost 1,000 acres. And during World War II and after World War II, it of course went toward mechanization. I can remember the nuns coming out and picking up potatoes in their long gowns, picking apples. Mother Superior out inspecting the dairy herds and the beautiful Belgian horses that they had.
Was there, I was young, but I seem to remember five different farms. There was St. Mary's number one and number two. And were they pretty much, did they provide basically everything for those institutions? I mean, fruit
pretty
and
much.
Vegetables and eggs? And,
well, I don't suppose all the fruit and vegetables, but definitely the eggs they had. Thousands of hens, they had fruit orchards, they had cows, they had a slaughterhouse where they butchered beef and hogs that they had raised on the farm and took to the city. And they processed the milk in town, in Monroe, for the academy and the boys' institution as well as the Mary Grove College. Yes, they were quite self-sufficient. I don't know if they raised, I don't ever recall them raising vegetables, but potatoes, yes.
Was that the Borges Avenue Dairy by any chance?
No,
used to process
no.
That
a fellow by the name of Ralph Spivin, who was a man who was afflicted with infantile paralysis when he was a youngster, who ran their dairy outside, in round and back of the mother house somewhere where the, I'd never been in it, but where the powerhouse was or somewhere in there. But, processed the milk. I'm not exactly sure. I just where they processed it. I don't think it was a Borges Avenue Dairy. I think that's another dairy. I remember that one.
Where exactly was that on Borges Avenue? Do you
remember? I remember the name, but I don't. I can't tell you. No, I shouldn't have said I remembered. I remember the name.
Mm-hmm.
There was Dan's Dairy. There was Independent Dairy. There was Pease Dairy. There were several little dairies.
Then in its heyday, there must have been a lot more dairy farming in the county than there is today.
Oh my, yes. Every farm had. My dad picked up milk and we hauled it to Mabee. And Mabee was a substation, as I mentioned, for a Detroit Creamery Company. And they came from all around, you know, 15, 20 miles. Every farmer had a can or two of milk. We produced about 4 cans of milk. And I remember one of the county officials being here, old Bill Jennings, one time, he walked in the milk house and saw 4 cans of milk in there. Boy, he said, that's really a lot of milk. Well, it isn't much milk anymore, but it was then.
Mm-hmm. What was it that drove the dairy business out of Monroe?
Well, my brothers and I, probably the last of the family. My brother Jack up here has a dairy farm yet. He just had heart surgery last week, so he may be going out. My brother Robert went out, oh, 10, 12 years ago out of the dairy. He just went out of farming a couple years ago. Oh, I suppose employment opportunities, lack of money, people not, you know, the necessity of bigger farms. It was, when you only got a can or two of milk a day, you were only getting $25-$30 a month for your milk, you know. It was just a piddling little amount in the 20s and 30s, but was enough to live on in those days.
Extra income.
Extra, a little extra income. Farming is totally different today.
Do you see this happening to crop farmers as well? I mean, the small guy with 300, 400, 500 acres going out, being taken over by the huge farms, the 3,000 to 5,000 acre people.
I don't know whether they're going to survive or not, the 3,000 to 5,000 acre people. They have a lot of financial trouble too. I suppose that's the trend. Everything seems to be getting bigger. I dislike it very much, but it's seems to be the trend of the times.
Mm-hmm. I understand you had quite a bit of involvement with the community college, with its inception and setting it up to start.
Well, I don't know if it's quite a lot. I was very interested at the outset of establishing the community college. There were committees formed to talk about curricula and financing and site location and various need studies about the whole thing. And my first involvement was after it had passed. I was very interested in it, and I thought that an ideal location for a community college would be the old county farm. Prior to that, several years, we had push water from the city of Monroe out to the county farm at the county infirmary where indigent people were kept. After that, we had built a juvenile detention facility in the county library there to use the water facilities and use the land. Fairgrounds was established on the county farm, and we felt that the Raisinville Road site would be an excellent site for the community college. And I, at that time, as chairman of the Board of Supervisors, and through my education committee man, Dale Wagonek, a supervisor from Summerfield Township, we arranged to, through our committee, to make an offer to the community college, feeling that it would be a great savings to the taxpayers to have 150 acres of land that they wouldn't have to go out and buy, and that we would be able to, in one sense, take money from one pocket, which was not our responsibility as county government, but which we were interested in, and put it in the other, the education pocket, and thereby really save the taxpayers money. And so Mr. Wagonek and I proceeded to make an offer to the community college people, and though I lost a lot politically by it, I thought it was the right thing to do. We had a group in our township from Ida who were very active in the educational field, and they wanted it in the area of Ida. But I felt that these people were self-serving and that they were interested more in the business aspects of it. It wasn't practical to get water and sewage to Ida, where it was practical to get water and sewage to the Raisinville site. So politically, in my own township, I did not do any favors. But it still was the right decision.
Now, when you speak of the infirmary, is that what we know now as Fairview?
Yes, yes. We had probably 60 or 70 people, indigent people in there that was necessary for, that was a way of taking care of the elderly poor through that facility. And I laugh at the observation of people at that time, well, we'll only use it for 10 years or so, and then that will no longer be a facility that we will use, liberal people were stating. Well, it's still being used today, 40 years later, and I think there are 15 or 20 residents, indigent residents there, and it's a good place to have for people who have no homes.
Was that originally built for that purpose?
Yes, and a county farm supported it. They had a herd of dairy cattle. They had their own vegetables. They had a superintendent, a farm superintendent. They raised their own hogs and chicken eggs and vegetables, and that farm went all the way back, as you see, all the way back to the community college, to another field beyond the community college. And that was just as wide as the fairgrounds at the community college is. That was used for farming purposes.
That's where all the indigents worked and
yes,
earned their keep, so to speak.
So to speak, they helped on the farm, and they also had hired men, but it was an occupation for the older people, and the women, they worked around in the laundries and the food and things like that. Those were able. A lot of people, of course, were not able to go there in their very last years.
Mm-hmm. How did the county come about that land?
Well, it was purchased by the county, I suppose. That was way before my time, but that's a standard procedure. I hate to use the word, but it was a county poor farm.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way they cared for their poor.
Mm-hmm. And then they were buried there in that potter's field.
Yes, that's correct. And that's why that spot just inside of the gate of Community College is a grove. Isn't there a couple of few trees there?
Mm-hmm.
And that's where they tried to not disturb any.
Not, yeah.
That was one of the conditions that they try not to disturb that burial ground.
Mm-hmm. Was there, as far as working on the plans for the community college, did you run into any serious opposition? Other than
I wasn't that close to it working on the plans. They hired Ron Campbell early, and I worked with him. I remember their offices were up above the Weissel Drugstore on the corner of 1st and Monroe Street, and I remember seeing models up in there. Is Barbara Needham still over there?
That doesn't sound familiar.
Doesn't seem, I guess she was in another, I guess she was in the intermediate district office, but she was very active in it. And I remember seeing models and discussing with Rob Campbell.
How was the public's opinion about that?
I don't remember the vote, but I think it was quite readily accepted. We were ready. I think the county was ready, growing. I think it's been a good cultural addition to the county. You know, everything is specialized now, and youngsters have to receive further education to compete in the job market, so it's been a good thing for the county.
Mm-hmm.
I am distressed by a lot of the faculty unionizing and all of that. It seems to me it's more important that some of these educational institutions are unionized than it is to teach the kids, and that discourages me very much.
Mm-hmm.
Mrs. Doty was a teacher, and that's an experience with being bumped off and having unqualified people teaching certain classes, and that discourages me very much.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of our higher educational institutions.
She's probably seen, referring to Mrs. Doty, she's probably seen quite some serious changes in teaching throughout the years, like
yes.
You mentioned that. Why are they there? Are they there to teach the kids, or is what's the prerogatives and the goals?
Well, she was an old-fashioned teacher and did her job, and was very involved with the youngsters, and seems to be quite a different atmosphere now. Of course, our children are out of school, and we're not that close to the educational institutions anymore. So.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe my observations are not as accurate as they might be, but I have an idea about everything. Opinion.
Yeah, don't we all? Yeah, we certainly do. Well, if you could go back over your years and do anything over.
It's been a hard life. The American farmer hasn't been treated very well. The policies of the government are for cheap food, and when we do get a little chance to make money, like in the 70s or so, when Nixon started exporting grain, the wrath of the country came down upon us, and everything else had to go up to take care of the food. The American people couldn't readjust to higher food prices because they were so accustomed to such a small percentage of their income going toward food compared to any place else in the world. They will not give up their boats and their second homes and their snowmobiles and their high standard of living to pay for the food, and so
Donald D. Doty has been associated with county government continuously since 1952. He was born in Raisinville Township, Monroe County, in 1923. A graduate of Monroe High School, he did extra work in adult education courses at LaSalle Extension University. He married Beverly M. Carr in 1951. She is a graduate of the University of Vermont and now teaches home economics at Mason Consolidated School in Erie, Michigan. They have three children, Pamela S., Sandra L., and Donald C. Doty owns a 188-acre dairy and grain farm, which has been in the Doty family since 1837, when the family settled in Monroe County after moving from eastern New York State. Don is following the family tradition of leadership. His great-grandfather's name appears in the minutes of the township meetings beginning in 1840. His grandfather was elected to office in 1878, and his father was supervisor in 1917. Don has held elected offices as township clerk and supervisor, as a member and chairman of county supervisors, chairman of Ways and Means Committee, delegate Michigan Constitutional Convention, and member Monroe County Board of Supervisors. His many other activities include being president and organizer of Monroe County 4-H Club Council, member, official board, St. Paul's Methodist Church,
member, Monroe County Planning Commission, Health Board, and Pension Board, plus various farm organizations.